You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
For a whole month leading up to Malaysia Day on the 16th of September, BFM, in collaboration with the Nutgraph, brings you a series of conversations all about being Malaysian.
My granddad was a ticket collector in a cinema. Which
he was actually a stowaway on a boat.
Yeah, we're the original Pendatang, you know.
My grandmother is actually from Southern Thai.
My mother's family were Bugis,
the from Hainan Island.
They were the pirates who arrived in Malacca.
Technically, Indonesia.
Long time ago.
Grandparents came from Kerala.
I feel Malaysian.
Oh, I'm totally Malaysian. We trace the bloodlines that connect and intersect us to paint a portrait of Malaysia today.
BFM 89.9, I'm Shifa Situ. In today's edition of Bloodlines, which is a series that examines our rich heritage, I have the great pleasure of speaking to Datuk Syarif Samad. I know you went to the Malay College Kuala Kangsar, which is a full Malay secondary school. What were your thoughts about race back in those days? I know that the school is fully Malay, but the teachers were, you know, British and all different races there. What were your feelings of race growing up?
I think I ended up in the Malay college because it was inconvenient. My parents were moving from place to place. In fact, I had in my primary education was in three different states, and I think by that time, my father probably decided that I should be more settled, and the choice was not made because it was a Malay institution, but probably it's much more convenient to send me to a boarding school. And at that particular time, I believe that was about the only boarding school we had, and that was in 1961. Thoughts of Malayness in those days. Well, I think why we didn't become so much Malay, although we were in a Malay institution, was that our teachers, as you said, were from various races, and including from the occasional Peace Corps, American Peace Corps, the wandering Mat Saleh, you know, who ended up in Kuala Kangsar or Malaya. So and when we see that our teachers were sitting, eating, playing together, or working together, there were no thoughts about whether you were Malay or Chinese or anything else. I really believe that it is because our teachers that impart that kind of, you know, outlook, you know, not towards whether you're Malay or non-Malay, or, you know, you don't really get that those kind of vibes. But that does not make you any less Malay. And being any less Malay or any more Malay does not make you any less Malaysian or more Malaysian.
I mean, true.
That's what I think should be, you know.
Yeah, but it seems though that now, I mean, these days people are a lot more concerned about, you know, emphasizing racial differences. I mean, is that something that you recognize, and have you seen a transformation from back then to now?
I confronted this matter, say, in sort of after coming out of Malay College, right? And then you were going into University of Malaya, and this was just right on during the May 13th, 1969. Well, I'm sorry to have to say this, because some people find great exception in being reminded that this happened. You know, it was a very conscious decision on my part that, okay, I have come from a Malay school. Not that I didn't know any non-Malay, but I had I shouldn't say this on radio because this might be caught by my wife. But they were also, you know, Chinese students from the day schools. There was a Chinese girl was from the day school who became a friend, and of course we had our teachers from other races as well. But on May 69, just a few days before we were supposed to enter the University of Malaya, the impact of May 69 also on me was that consciously I decided that I should get to have a few non-Malay friends, right?
Okay.
Otherwise, all my friends would be Malays. So that was a conscious decision to look for non-Malay friends.
I know that at MU, when you were studying there, I mean, what was the atmosphere like? I mean, these days there's a lot of talk around, you know, students not being politically active. Did you have sort of a rising of awareness when you went to university?
No, this is the first time we experienced tear gas, you know. That's where you learn and you how tear gas feels like with your eyes and your nose. That's in 1969. That was at the time of Anwar Ibrahim and student radicalism, and he was there earlier because he was my senior, and there were constant debates and elections, and you know, and so it was exciting times. But I suppose everybody was, whether they care to admit it or not, were affected by May 1969.
Sure.
And I think there was, the toning down of the sense that even though we were politically active, the toning down, that we would like to be, we'll say, more, not so extreme or more Malaysian or whatever, you know. But I don't know what the university scene is now. But I imagine you have the same, you know, you have the same group of people, those who are interested in politics, those who are interested in just studying, those who are interested in going with boys, and those who are boys who are interested in going for girls.
But I guess universities are supposed to build the next generation of leaders, and now with the focus being much more, you know, on career and making money, and there seems to be less political activism, you know, encouraged at university level. Does that affect the quality of leaders that we'll get in the future?
I think I was not active in politics in MU. I don't think it's whether it is a problem that you are only focused on your careers. You know, I was myself focused on my career. I wanted to be a banker, for example, because that's the scholarship I got for when I was in MU. But I think what is really needed to me, if I now with the benefit of hindsight of 60 years, is that perhaps. Is really character building, you know, it's principles, it's character, it is honesty, it is the willingness to work hard. That part, rather than, you know, whether you are active in politics, whether you want to be to have a career, or whether you want to you're chasing after a girl or whatever, you know, I think this in university, I mean, in that context, in that period, I think it's much more to me is about. Can we build character? Can we infuse people with values? Values for concern beyond ourselves.
Okay, so from wanting to be a banker to becoming the youngest political secretary in Malaysia in 1973, I believe, what happened? What made you go into politics?
It didn't seem like a big switch, but what happened was that I just thought then, let me give it a try. Maybe I thought that, you know, there's some role I could play. I mean, there's something I could do or something I could learn on the job. And so once I took up the job, then you just get sucked in.
So 30 years later, what did you learn?
30 years later. 30 years later, I think this is a great country. It needs good leaders. It needs good people to be committed to the country. It needs institutions that it had or had at one time to continually to be strong. And I think so we can maintain, you know. And
I mean, obviously, you've seen a lot of Malaysia go through a lot of changes in terms of economic growth, societal changes. What has been the impact on Malaysian culture of all these changes, dramatic changes that's occurred? You know, how we relate to each other.
Oh, I see. Whether
the economic growth, maybe sometimes people say it's happened so rapid that in some areas we might not be as progressive as we'd like to be.
Yeah, that's the trouble of being in this country, isn't it? That you know, it's we are so different, you know, and yet we are together. And I think when people ask me about what my thoughts after this, well, this 30 years, you said 30 years, I can recall. I said, for example, I can recall the time that now we are having our fasting month, Ramadan. that when we break fast in those days, it was with dates that were packed into a, you know, like a butter slab, you know, right? So this is probably category C dates or something like that. You know, and now today we are talking about dates, individual dates, and even fresh dates on, we're still on the stocks. And so time really has changed. As we have moved forward, we have progressed. I think about my own community, for example, in Ramadan now I see my friends going to go and do the Umrah. And it's an expensive time. You know, it's second most expensive time to do your Umrah. Or when rentals are high in Mecca, is during Ramadan. I see Malaysians just, you know, almost like at a drop of a hat, you know, going off to do Umrah in Mecca. And I think we probably have, 50,000... Malaysians doing Umrah in every year, and if you multiply that by 5,000 ringgit, you have a substantial amount of money, which means this and money for pilgrimage and is actually just extra money, right? It just shows how opulent or how wealthy we have become. You know?
But are there any negative side effects to this opulence?
Yes, I think there is. I think it goes back to what I said, you know, that I wonder about the values, you know, then when you go to university, I suppose, is that where you could learn these values? Or was it something that is something that you learned at school? Or is it something that your parents, implanted in you? I mean, I'm not so sure, but I think as we progress, you know, and if you do not have those values, and our values are just for ourselves, then, of course, there are many negative things that can happen. One is, of course, being selfish. One is just,
take things
for granted and just bitch around and keep complaining about this and that. And I suppose it affects everybody. To me, it just affects everybody. I'm not just complaining about the ordinary guy. I'm talking about, you know, practically everybody else.
All right. I mean, I know you mentioned values. I mean, both you and your brother, MP Khalid Salman, is known for a very, direct, straightforward way of communicating. Is this a personality trait that you think you got growing up or that you share?
I think I'm different from my brother because he is a child of his generation, right? I went to university in 1969 and in Malaysia, you know, a local university. And that was the time of nationalism and the NEP, Tun Razak, the anger with Tengku Abdul Rahman, you know. I'm a product of that time and definitely influenced by those events. And my brother went to do his education in England, UK. So, and that was the time of the Islamic Reformation, Islamic Revolution, and so on and so forth. In fact, I recall he came back and wanted to form this IRP. You know? So he said it was Islamic R Party. So I said, what's R going to be? Is it going to be revolutionary or is it going to be Republican? Either way, you're going to be in trouble. So he probably took my advice and just joined PAS instead of trying to form his own party. So we are of different times. But I don't know, maybe it is in our upbringing that materialism is not so big deal. I mean, we should be comfortable, happy with what we have, you know, and that kind of thing. I always relate this to the fact that we just drink boiled water every time, you know, boiled water we just put in the fridge rather than syrup or Coca-Cola in our meals. I have other siblings. They are also like that in a sense, although they're not active in politics, but also again, you know, in the sense that maybe we believe too much in moderation.
much moderation is a bad thing.
We believe that, you know, things should be moderate, life should be moderate, we're conscious about our, you know, how others should perceive us. And
You mentioned the inception of the NEP, back in the day. Lately, there's been some accusations that the NEP has been corrupted. What do you feel about this?
I think the NEP sort of was abandoned in 1990, because by 1988, the Industrial Coordination Act, which was actually one of the key legislation, I would say, to implement the NEP, the conditions of the NEP, because the Industrial Coordination Act requires any industrial companies, manufacturing companies, to have all the conditions of the NEP. Mm-hmm. And the ICA was used, the Industrial Coordination Act was used to enforce the conditions of the NEP, and that was abolished in the late 80s. And that, to me, was really the end of the NEP.
So what are we left with now? What is the remnants?
I think we have to learn to pick up the good things. I mean, what we should do. I mean, it's important for us to pick up from what we have then or what we given up then. We should pick up then, of course, on the issue of poverty eradication, right? On the issue of restructuring society. How do you do it? Mm-hmm. How is it then done? And those are the issues. Those are the questions which have to be answered, because I think after 1990. You had various sorts of government strategies and policies, and then everybody says, oh, at the end of it all, the underlining this is the NEP. Is it really the NEP that is underlining this? You know, mm-hmm. behind all these policies like privatization,
yeah.
you know, we went through this period of heavy privatization. Boom, boom, boom. Everything gets privatized. It has its good part. It's got its bad part. And then today we have to move away from a reasonably we have survived that the 90s. We have to decide what do we do with the next 10 years.
I mean, how do you think Malaysia looks, you know, poised for the next 10 years? A lot of people are now talking about being trapped in this middle income thing, and
sounds exotic.
Foreign investment is dropping. All these sort of signs. Should we be worried?
I think I wouldn't be worried if we know where we want to go. I think that the signs are there. What we have to do. What we have been successful during the period of heavy investment. In infrastructure, to create companies that can go outside of Malaysia. We are so fortunate that as a country, that while we experiment and learn and make the mistakes or gain good experience in businesses locally, we are taking also that experience and the wealth and the management experience to other in the form of enterprises overseas in China, in Vietnam, in Cambodia, and everywhere else.
Mm.
So we can't be bad. And I suppose the next wave would be is how, while we strengthen our own domestic market, we also should learn how to work well with our neighbors.
I guess it's the AirAsia model, right?
Well, AirAsia realizes that.
Yeah.
And that it is not just about, I think it's not just about Kuala Lumpur to Cebu or Kuala Lumpur to Kuching, but it's also Kuala Lumpur to Surabaya. And thank God, you know, we have Indonesians working in Malaysia who wants to use our planes.
Yeah.
I think the real potential, I think, is still in our region, Malaysia, Indonesia, for example. Mm. Singapore, of course, to me, is just, you know, wants to be this port in this ocean, wants to be everything to everyone. Okay, fine, you know, a financial center, blah, blah, blah. But I think the real substance and the real market and the real economic muscle that will come, I think, is Indonesia and Malaysia and perhaps even Thailand, you know, and mm-hmm. all the ASEAN region.
All right, if we talk a little bit more, I mean, return to the issue of, you know, racial harmony and such. I mean, do you feel that Malaysia has become more polarized these days or not?
You know, this is the first time I was asked this question was after the 2004 elections. And I kept wondering why that question kept coming. I was convinced that there was no such thing as racial polarization. But everybody else who came to see me was saying, no, we are racially polarized. Yeah, but...
So is this something that people are just, propagating and doesn't reflect reality?
No, it is there. But while it is there, what are we doing about it?
Mm. I mean, that's my next question.
That's my question, you know. Well, you say, there's racial polarization. Yeah, but I see if racial polarization today compared to 1969, I couldn't go to Auckland Road, you know. without, I would not see anybody. It was just, I'll just see Chinese villagers, for example, in Old Klang Road. But today it is open up. I mean, it's Malays, Chinese, Indians, everybody is there working together and but not eating at the same table. I mean, is that a problem? that kind of issue. But at the same time, I find Malaysia has abundant opportunity to create racial polarization. Right? And the more, if you want to talk about it, and if you want to say there is, it is there, you can find it.
Easy to see what you want to see, right?
You know, you want is how. So actually, in Malaysia, it is very easy to decide if you want to be racial, right? And racial is, I think, racialism or racism is, to me, is a two-edged sword. You know, because you point at someone for being racist, you probably. You're equally racist as well.
Obviously, Malaysia has this amazing diversity, right? And on one hand, it gives us opportunity to become very racist, but on the other hand, it's a huge resource, right?
That's right.
I mean, what kind of advice would you give or guidance would you give to, say, you know, your grandchildren growing up in a country that has that particular makeup that Malaysia has?
Oh, my God. Why do I have to give advice to my grandchildren? I hope I don't have to.
They advise you instead.
No, I would like, I really like, would like to listen to what they have to say. You know, rather than me telling them, hey, you know, those days when I was like, I'm sure they're going to retort and say, hey, granddad, you know, those days are long gone, you know. And I don't think anyone should be advising our own grandchildren. I think my children should look after them. Okay. I know if we're going to be responsible for our grandchildren, you know, I think that's when the problem begins.
That was, of course, Dr. Ukshayu Samad, and I'm Shifa Situ.
You've been listening to Bloodlines, a series dedicated to our rich heritage. This series is brought to you in collaboration with The Nutgraft and their upcoming book, Found in Malaysia, available at all good bookstores. This is BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.